Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen Demores, author of America the Almighty, the Maverick Hyperpower, who assesses the global repercussions of the Bush administration's unilateral foreign policy. Simon Harrick, Jesuit priest and an organizer with the War Resisters League, who takes a critical look at the contradictions he sees in the pro-life position promoted by Republicans and conservative Christians around the Terri Schiavo life support case. And Avis Jones DeWeaver, with the Institute for Women's Policy Research, who discusses wage inequalities by race and gender revealed in a new Census Bureau study. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of the citizen uprising that forced out longtime Kyrgyzstan strongman Askar Akayev, opposition leader Edil Baysalov of the Coalition for Democracy and Civil Society showed off his orange wool scarf, a souvenir of last winter's so-called Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. Inspired by pro-democracy campaigns in Ukraine and Georgia, opposition groups in Kyrgyzstan tried to use the same tactics to protest a flawed election. Akayev fled to Russia as the opposition overwhelmed security forces and took over government offices, including the state-run television station. His supporters blamed the uprising on American funding of opposition groups. Grants to opposition groups came from the U.S.-based National Democratic Institute and Freedom House, a New York-based human rights group. In February, power was cut off to Freedom House's printing press in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, where opposition newspapers were printed. Neighboring former Soviet republics have refused to register Freedom House and George Soros's Open Society Institute. Igor Satarov, a former ministry spokesman in neighboring Tajikistan, observed, "After Georgia and Ukraine, we have certain concerns about these Western democratic promotion organizations." Freedom House denied it engages in partisan political activity and claimed that governments in Central Asia that criticize civil society groups are just trying to divert attention away from heavy-handed tactics used to manipulate elections. Pinochet-era Labour Minister John Pinera is credited by free market libertarians with inspiring George W. Bush to push for privatization of Social Security. In 1997, Pinera was invited to the Texas governor's mansion to have dinner with Bush along with Ed Crane, founder and president of the libertarian Cato Institute. Crane says Pinera, who created Chile's pension privatization scheme, convinced Bush about the lure of private accounts. Pinera, a close ally of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, and free marketeers like Milton Friedman, pushed through a law in Chile that cracked down on labor rights, restricting the right to organize, limiting the right to strike, and to bargain for fair wages. In 1981, Pinera set up a privatized pension plan that required all workers to sign up for private accounts. The transition to the private retirement system was expensive, paid for by cuts in social programs, selling off state industries, and floating bonds. Now, many question the private system that Pinera established. In 2004, the World Bank, usually a fan of privatization, published a highly critical report of the private retirement system in Latin America. Today, many Chilean workers who put money into the private system cannot afford to retire and must rely on government social services to survive. Others are pushing back their retirement age as they are unable to live on their meager private pensions. Tuberculosis is at an all-time low, not only in the United States, but also in much of the rest of the world. However, this highly transmittable disease is raging across the African continent. According to the 2005 Tuberculosis Control Report issued by the World Health Organization, TB rates in Africa have tripled since 1990 at a rate of 3-4% a year. In most other developed nations, tuberculosis rates are falling 3-4% annually, a trend that is in line with a recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. According to USA Today, the high TB rates in Africa are directly linked to the AIDS pandemic sweeping the continent. Lee Reichman of the New Jersey-based National Tuberculosis Center says TB treatment for AIDS patients can extend their lives 2 to 5 years, long enough to get them on antiretroviral drug treatment. Reichman declared, "We know what causes TB, we know how to treat it, we know how to prevent it, and we are not doing it." But public health experts also worry about the spread of a new drug-resistant form of TB that is moving across Russia. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
A new poll published on March 28th found that far fewer Australians had a positive view of the United States as compared to other nations and groups such as China, France, and the United Nations. Alarmingly, Australians, a people who have long been a staunch ally of the U.S., were evenly divided on whether American foreign policy or Islamic fundamentalism presented a greater threat to the world today. Last year, a survey conducted in European and Arab nations by the Pew Global Attitudes Project found increasing hostility toward America and its foreign policy. The public opinion poll revealed that since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, anger at America had intensified among the people of France, Germany, and Britain. In Muslim countries, resentment against the U.S. was found to be pervasive. Critics maintain that antipathy toward the U.S. in much of the world illustrates the damage done to America's standing by President Bush's unilateral and militaristic foreign policy since the September 11th terrorist attacks. With President Bush's appointment of John Bolton to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, despite his long record of hostility toward the world body, concern is growing about the direction of America's foreign policy in Mr. Bush's second term. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stephen Demores, a former officer with the U.S. State Department and author of the book America the Almighty, The Maverick Hyperpower. Demores assesses the global repercussions of the Bush administration's neoconservative-driven foreign policy.
I think that basically the worldview of the neoconservatives who were in control of the Pentagon with people like Rumsfeld and Thief being at the top of the Pentagon, or very close to the top of the Pentagon, the view was that the world needs stability, and the best way to achieve stability is by an American empire, an empire basically not of American cooperation or leadership, but of American dominance by force if necessary, using our overwhelming military power as the source of our power. And basically the theory behind that is that we ought to be spreading democracy and free market capitalism all over the world, and that those forces would eventually create a more stable and benign world. Of course, the contradiction there and the reason that the theory doesn't work is that the coercive use of military force contradicts human freedom and contradicts the fundamental values behind democracy and, of course, contradicts American values. We don't believe in being bullies. We believe in cooperation. I mean, I'm talking about the American people now. So basically, an American empire enforced by military dominance is, you know, promoting democracy is a self-contradictory concept. But that's where the neoconservatives are coming from, who basically called the shots, including the literal shots of the Iraq war over the last 4 or 5 years.
How has the United States specifically countered a drive around the world to codify international law, universal law that would apply to all countries and codify, in essence, some basic human rights?
Well, it's really a wonderful thing when you look at it that the other democracies of the world, and even a great many countries that are not democracies, have strongly supported two major human rights treaties, treaties on the rights of women and the rights of children. Both of those treaties, the President Carter and other presidents supported those treaties, but the Senate refused to ratify them. And then a major treaty on justice, the Treaty on the International Criminal Court, basically, Bill Clinton signed that one of those very last days in office, but since then, Bush has unsigned it, has reversed his signature. A really important matter of sustainable prosperity throughout the world, the Kyoto Protocols on global warming, the United States has, under Bush, aggressively rejected that, while other countries have pretty much embraced it, not by any means all of them, but the treaty is now in effect. A whole raft of arms control treaties, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, Chemical and Biological Weapons Treaties. These are treaties that you want to have in place to control weapons of mass destruction, and you would think you would certainly want to have them in place in the context of the war on terrorism, and yet we weakened, undermined, or completely pulled out of those treaties. So across the board, we've opposed international law on matters of principle, and we're now the most feared and disliked nation in the world in many ways, rather than the most admired nation as we were before.
Stephen DeMores, to sum up, what price has the U.S. paid for its militaristic and unilateral foreign policy in the wake of the September 11th attacks on this country? And how can U.S. citizens work to change and redirect our government's policy toward the rest of the world?
Well, I think the price has been a tremendous loss of moral authority and political support for the United States. I mean, basically, we, even in countries where the government supports us, as in England and formerly in Spain and Japan, the people of those countries don't support us. They're hostile to us because of the Iraq War. We've intensified anti-American feeling in the Middle East, and we've created brand new anti-American feeling among the people of our democratic allies. And we're paying a very high price. Cooperation across the board has been drastically curtailed, and everything we try to do is more difficult to do in a cooperative way with the rest of the world. As far as what American citizens can do, about all we can do is organize to put pressure in a new direction. We can vote in the House and the Senate for candidates who are supportive of a benign and multilateral policy, a policy of cooperation with the UN and international institutions, and we can press for those things in terms of joining and participating in organizations that support those things. I'm a member of Citizens for Global Solutions, also a member of the United Nations Association. There are a number of other organizations out there as well that work hard on basically creating a more benign foreign policy. An example right now is John Bolton's nomination to be our ambassador to the United Nations. He hates the United Nations with a purple passion and will do everything he can to destroy it. So these organizations are working against Bolton's nomination and trying to get him not approved by the Senate. And that's the kind of thing the American public can do. We can join in. We can write to our senators and say, hey, we don't need hostile, bellicose people like Bolton as our ambassador to the UN. We need to be saying to our Democratic senators and representatives, hey, get some backbone. Stand up to this stuff. It's damaging our standing in the world and costing us an awful lot, and it's promoting war rather than peace. It's not what we want. We need to tell our representatives that we want a different policy.
That was Stephen DeMores, author of America the Almighty, The Maverick Hyperpower. For more information, visit DeMores' website at www.americatheallmighty.com. The family dispute surrounding the case of Terry Schiavo in Florida has in recent weeks drawn the nation into a heated debate on end-of-life ethics. The Republican Party, working to gain favor with the conservative Christian movement, a key ally, has led Congress to make an unprecedented but unsuccessful effort to intervene in determining the fate of Ms. Schiavo, who, according to doctors, has been in a persistent vegetative state for 15 years. Although Florida's courts determined that Terry's husband was rightfully carrying out the brain-damaged woman's wishes by terminating life support, in the face of challenges by her parents, congressional Republicans passed special legislation narrowly addressing the Schiavo case in an attempt to exploit their personal tragedy for political advantage. A Republican Party memo with talking points about their Schiavo-related bill circulated on the floor of the U.S. Senate referenced the upcoming election of a Democratic senator. The memo stated, quote, "This is a great political issue because Senator Nelson of Florida has already refused to become a co-sponsor, and this is a tough issue for Democrats," end quote. The Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who has aggressively led the fight to overturn the judgment of Florida's courts to remove a feeding tube from Terry Schiavo, had himself, 16 years ago, agreed to withdraw life support from his severely injured father. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Simon Harrick, Jesuit priest and anti-militarism coordinator with the War Resisters League, who takes a critical look at the contradictions he sees in the culture of life promoted by Republicans and conservative Christians around the Terry Schiavo case.
Everybody who is involved in this on a political level is saying, geez, how important every human life is. The president's saying it's important to err on the side of life, and delay is saying that every human life deserves attention. At the same time as they're saying this, we're engaged in this invasion occupation of Iraq, which The Lancet, the foremost medical journal in the world, reported has taken the lives of 100,000 Iraqis. In other words, what we're unwilling to have, at least the politicians are saying, they're unwilling to have happen to Terry Shuttle. They are instead inflicting that same kind of suffering and death, and worse, on 100,000 individuals in Iraq. That's the part that gets me thinking, well, this sounds contradictory to me. Or else the millions upon millions of dollars we spend to kill people on death row. The same amount of money that could have been spent and could be being spent to keep Terry Schiavo alive, we spend on killing people. So I'm puzzled as to how all of a sudden we become moral in one particular case, and then in all these other cases, even though we're saying human life is precious, we don't act like that. In fact, we act in quite the reverse way. We go out of our way to kill people, and that's what puzzles me, the contradictions puzzle me.
President Bush famously said recently, referring to the Terry Schiavo case, that we as a nation should err on the side of life. As you've been saying, that doesn't really jive with President Bush's own policies on the death penalty, the war in Iraq, even health care for Americans. There is no effort on the part of his government and many politicians to provide health care for those who need it the most.
Yes, and that, as I said, for me, that's the contradiction. I guess it really is at some particular point, one hates to quote the scripture, but at one particular point, Jesus tells the Pharisees that they are straining out the gnat and swallowing the camel. And it's, even though it's a humorous thing, it seems to be extremely true in this particular case, that we're giving a good amount of attention, and again, it's a tragic case, to Terry Schiavo, at the same time hoping, perhaps, I don't know what the motivation is, but hoping that people won't notice that we're cutting Medicaid, that we are charging our veterans more for their health care, even after the coming back of serving in Iraq, that we're cutting that we don't have a universal health care plan, that instead of having universal health, we make choices with our budget. And what we've chosen to do with this budget is give $425 billion, that's a billion, to the military, which works out, everybody should get out their calculators and calculate out that this works out to be around $12,000 a second on, let's face it, killing people.
As a religious man yourself, Father Herrick, what are your concerns, if any, about how government and religion, in the case of Christian fundamentalism, have kind of been blended here in a way that I think alarms some people in this country who believe in a healthy separation of church and state?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, it is. There's healthy separations of church and state, but at the same time, I always feel that the church or the people of religion should have a voice, especially in a voice in public policy, and especially when it concerns, and it always does, matters of morality. I hope that folks will listen to people of every faith who say that war is wrong, that death penalty is wrong. I hope that no one draws a line and says you can't talk about that, although people try to do that. What I'm, again, concerned about is that when this happens, it seems that it's happening for a particular reason. I'm sure that you heard the Republican memo that said, oh, we should go after this because our right-to-life base will be pleased that we're going after the Schiavo case. Well, that doesn't sound like the best motivation in the world. Again, well, all we're doing it is to try to curry favor with certain groups of people we feel are powerful. That doesn't sound like a good motivation to me, and yet that's what's happening. It's another step, unfortunately, in an attempt to try to get power over people's conscience and then say, okay, look at how moral we are. Don't look over here where we're killing all these people. Look over this where we're making this big fuss over here, but don't look over there in Iraq. Don't look into Palestine. Don't look to Afghanistan. Don't look to the 154 people that were put to death under Bush in Texas while he was governor. Don't look there. Just look down here in Florida, and then you'll see how wonderful we are. Well, personally, I feel that one case is too small a database to make a fair evaluation on, and I appreciate the concern people are displaying for this one case, but I think a broader database, that is, looking at what we actually do for life, and what we do for death, that will kind of show a little bit more clearly what, as it says again in the scripture, by their fruits you will know them. They'll show a little bit more clearly the nature of what we're looking at. We're looking at people who are really pursuing death and then every once in a while throwing a bone in toward the direction of life, and then people scurry after that bone and think, gee, aren't these people terrific? Well, not according to my research. I don't see terrific commitment to life there.
That was Simon Harrick, Jesuit priest and anti-militarism coordinator with the War Resisters League. Contact the League by calling area code 212-228-0454 or visit their website at www.warresisters.org. A new report released in late March by the U.S. Census Bureau on the average earnings of workers with a four-year college education reveals that African American and Asian women earn significantly more than white women. Asian American women average almost $44,000 a year, while black women make $41,000 and white women just under $38,000. The survey also shows that white women earn just 58% of the $66,000 that white men with a bachelor's degree earn. Among men, whites earn the most, followed by Asians, then Hispanics, with African Americans in last place. Far fewer black men than black women have college degrees. One explanation for these disparities, offered by economists and sociologists, takes into account the fact that minority women tend to hold more than one job at a time, work more than 40 hours a week, and return to the workforce earlier than other groups after childbirth. Racial discrimination on the job continues to create obstacles in hiring and advancement to management positions among men. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Avis Jones DeWeaver, a researcher and study director with the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C., about the survey results. She says that while more analysis is needed to fully understand the numbers, one thing is clear. Higher education benefits men and women of all ages in the job market.
The big story here is that education works and education pays, particularly if you look at, for example, comparing the earnings of women who don't have a college degree across race. You find then that while Asian Americans are still on top, they're then followed by white Americans and then African Americans. So having a college degree pays for everyone, but it's particularly important to women of color and most apparently important to African American women. Unfortunately, at both extremes of the educational ladder, Latinas are at the bottom. Let me also put those numbers into context, because the numbers that were cited in that article looked at means or averages. Typically, economists tend to use medians, and let me tell you the difference and why that's important. Averages or means, they include people who maybe are at the far end of the spectrum, like, you know, it can include Oprah, you know what I'm saying, which could really throw off what that number is. Medians are the numbers that we kind of like to use because they provide a more fair representation of what the typical person makes. And while the general relationship is still there in terms of Asian American women earning the most and then African American women and white women and Latinas, there is a big difference there in what we see in terms of what people actually earn. For example, using those figures, African American women do not make over $40,000 a year. Their earnings is just $37,000 per year, while white women are only 36. It's definitely nowhere near, for example, the $41,000 that's attributed to black women when you look at the averages instead. And I think that's pretty important when you talk about what's really a fair representation of what the typical person makes.
Oh, absolutely. And I guess that would also apply to the average of white men's earnings of $66,000, right?
Exactly. When you change that and you look at median instead, for example, the earning of the typical earning of men, of white men, for example, would be that drops that all the way down to like 51,000 for a bachelor's degree. And then if you look at black men, then a bachelor's degree, that's 41,000. For Asian American men, that's 46,000. So it's a lot more complex than we really kind of can tell from all the focus that it's getting today.
And I guess these data also don't include people who go to law school or medical school or business school, right?
In terms of those overall numbers, if you're looking at 4 years or more and get those numbers kind of averaged out there, the median earnings, the same sort of relationship exists that we see when you just look at the bachelor's degree. It's just that the extremes between the two aren't as much.
So what do you make of the data in this report then?
I think what we're seeing here is a context of what's going on with people culturally, what's going on with people in terms of their choices, particularly after they have children, and what's going on with people in terms of their choices once they get into college. What do they choose to major in? In terms of cultural choices, I think it's important, particularly if you want to compare the black-white dynamic, I think it's important to note here that African-American women have a long history of work. From the days they set foot on the shore, they have worked historically, agriculturally, domestically. And the reason why that's important is because black women then come from a tradition where it's not unusual for your mother to have worked. And given that that's the case, black women are less likely to see working after having children as something that's abnormal, you know, or even, you know, bad in a sense, okay? Contrast that with the white woman's experience, who was largely just first introduced to the work world during World War II, taking the place of the men who had gone off to the war and then reintroduced after the women's movement. And so that is a cultural dynamic that perhaps does not have as long of a history of this idea that working is normal after having a child. And so I think part of what we're seeing here in terms of these earnings differentials can be reflected in the likelihood of African-American women to go back to work sooner and to work longer hours after having children than her white counterpart does, particularly among women who have higher levels of education. Another aspect of that is, what are her choices given her household dynamics? Okay. As you mentioned earlier, white men still outpace everyone else in terms of their earning power. And because of that, white women perhaps have more options after she has children in terms of whether or not to decide to go back to work or stay home a little bit longer with her child. Black men, though, earn much less than white men, and they are less likely, for example, there are far fewer of them, numerically speaking, than black women who have at least a bachelor's degree. And so because of that, black women's earning power is larger in her specific household than it is for a white woman's earning power. Because of that, also, that might be another pressure that black women feel to go back to work, because she sees that not only as a cultural norm, but also as an economic necessity.
That was Avis Jones DeWeaver, a researcher and study director with the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Contact the Institute at area code 202-785-5100 or visit their website at www.iwpr.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.